Court will now hear case number 09-CA-2769, People against Ehrlich. Counsel, I know you're both experienced. Do you have any questions about the procedures? Right. Thank you. You may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156, public defender. I'm here today representing Ms. Valerie Ehrlich. The question before the court this morning is whether the law allows police to seize a Colorado citizen simply because that person pulled their car off of a road and into a darkened parking lot. The answer to that question is no. My objective here this morning is to reiterate that the question really is that simple, and its answer requires reversal of this case. Now, the Attorney General has suggested that this court can find that no seizure occurred at all. Laws bear, however, that as soon as Deputy Tanner pulled his patrol car behind my client and activated his overhead lights, she was seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Additionally, and dispositively here, the fact that a seizure occurred was not disputed in the trial. The Colorado Supreme Court held People v. Salazar that if it's not argued in the trial court that a stop is consensual, then that cannot be raised for the first time on appeal. So unless this court has additional questions about that particular aspect of this case, I won't spend any more time talking about whether a seizure occurred here. We'll proceed to discuss why the seizure did occur was constitutionally unreasonable. In order for an officer to seize an individual for investigatory purposes, three criteria have to be met. Two of those are not at issue in this case. We have not argued on appeal either that the purpose of the detention or the character of the detention was unreasonable. So the only criteria that's at issue here is whether Deputy Tanner had an articulable and specific basis to believe that my client had committed, was committing, or was about to commit a crime. And even within that issue, the question gets narrower, because the evidence was undisputed that at the time the seizure occurred, he hadn't observed any criminal activity.
Mr. Evans, sorry to interrupt. Let's assume there was a seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Your client admitted to a crime independent of the seizure.
That's correct, Your Honor. But under the applicable Fourth Amendment case law here, the question of whether or not the seizure was reasonable, whether a police officer on the street can stop a person and detain them, is completely independent for whether or not the person was later found to be guilty of the crime. And what the law makes clear is that what's discovered after the point of the seizure does not count at all toward the evaluation whether or not the seizure was reasonable in the first instance. So, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. My client admitted that she had a methamphetamine pipe shortly after she was stopped.
Does that have any bearing on the analysis?
As to whether or not the seizure was reasonable, no, it doesn't.
Let's assume it was unreasonable. What's the outcome of the case?
If the seizure was constitutionally unreasonable, then any evidence gathered in violation of the United States of the Colorado Constitution cannot be presented.
Okay, the evidence of the pipes and all that, would that also extend to the confession?
Absolutely. When this court looks at whether or not evidence obtained in violation of the Constitution, this court looks at the geographic and the temporal proximity between the constitutional violation and the evidence that's obtained. And here, it's a direct result. And the closest analogy that I can point this court to would be the case where the officers detain an individual on the street at 1:50 in the morning. It's subsequently found by the Supreme Court, no reasonable suspicion to do that. The evidence obtained shortly thereafter, because it was so close to time and so close to space, could not be presented.
Counsel, here we have, it wasn't just dark, and it was late at night at an hour that, you know, the vast majority of people aren't out at all. There wouldn't appear to be any reason for a person to be at a warehouse this late at night. We have presumably an experienced officer who testified that putting all these things together, he thought there was a possibility here of some illegal activity. Why isn't putting all that together enough?
I want to make 2 points in response to what you said, Judge Jones. The first is that what you said and what the district court said ruling on this was there wasn't any reason for her to be there. But that conclusion turns the burden of proof around here. It's once you accept that my client was seized without a warrant, the burden was on the state, and it remains on the state, prove that this seizure came within one of the limited exceptions of the warrant required. And here, it's not my client's job. It's not my job to show that she could be there. It's the state's job to show that she couldn't be there, that there was something wrong with her presence at that place. And they haven't done that. And the second response to that, and what one of the main reasons that I wanted to bring this case to argument, was to point out the pattern that you see in all of the case law that we've cited. And the Attorney General and I, we put a lot of Fourth Amendment case law in briefs. And when you look at that catalog of cases talking about when reasonable suspicion justifies detaining someone, one of the patterns that becomes clear is that just the fact that a person is at a certain place at a certain time isn't enough. There has to be something that person does while they're there that gives rise to an inference of criminal activity. And that something related to the individual is present in every one of the cases relied upon by the Attorney General. In Rushden, in which they placed the most weight, that defendant was digging in a dumpster when police spotted him. And when he spotted the police, he immediately got out and started to leave, went back toward his car. And a division of this court relied on that, those actions by Mr. Rushden, to distinguish that case from Padgett and to find that reasonable suspicion justified seizing.
Mr. Evans, is the record clear as to whether she was still in this private road or this warehouse road, or whether she was on the public road when she was stopped, when she stopped herself and the policeman then came up behind her?
My best interpretation of the record is that she was still in the warehouse district, and she had been on a east-west road, and this district was oriented north-south, and she dipped down, drove around the district, and then what it sounds like to me is just before she got back onto the public road, she stopped the car, and that's when the seizure.
So you agree she was on private land trespassing?
I have no idea what the status of that land was, and it's important to recognize that the district court didn't find that this was proper private property. It found that it was possibly private property. So that fact...
Is that suspicion?
No. Even if the court would have that this was private property, the fact that something's private property does not mean definitively that you're not allowed to be there. Now, of course, you're right. It implicates the trespass statutes, but every single one of those statutes requires an unlawful entry onto the property. And it's undisputed that this was a business. And any business, at least any business that relies on customers, is not going to definitively say that it's unlawful to come onto our property. So the record
at 2:45 in the morning?
There are some businesses where it is probably clearly...
Well, this wasn't a 7-Eleven.
It wasn't a 7-Eleven, Your Honor, but when you read the record, it sounds like a warehouse district with a bunch of garages. It sounds equivalent to a storage unit, and many of those are 24-hour access. The point is, the record's not developed enough to say that she was trespassing, because there's nothing indicating that was an unlawful entry, and the deputy was asked, did you see any no trespassing signs? He said no. More importantly, he was asked, did you see any criminal activity? And if she was trespassing, that trespass was complete the second she walked onto the land. So when he asked, was there any criminal activity going on? And the deputy said, not that I saw. That is, in effect, saying, I didn't see her trespassing. So the record certainly does not show that she was violating the law just by her presence there. And in all of the cases that we've cited, where all you have to go on is a time and a place, where all you're saying is that they were at the wrong place at the wrong time, our courts have consistently held that that doesn't amount to reasonable suspicion. The fact that a person is just outside of their home late at night, even if, unlike in this case, they're outside of their home in a high crime area, that doesn't mean that the police can seize them. And you see Colorado courts supporting that idea in Padgett, in Outlaw, in Greer, in Davis, in Salazar. And the pattern that emerges is that just being at the wrong place at the wrong time isn't enough. But time and place were all that Deputy Tanner had. It's undisputed that it was late at night, there were no other people around. But it's equally undisputed that all my client did was turn off the road and drive around that warehouse district. There was no criminal activity. She didn't do anything to arouse suspicion other than be out late at night at a place where no other people were around. And the district court's ruling was not based on any of her behavior. The basis for the court's ruling was just the environmental factors. It was late. There were no other people. There were no other vehicles. And those things are all perfectly obvious.
Didn't the court also say it? There could be wires and different things stolen?
Absolutely. The court and the deputy recognized that sometimes warehouses get broken into, but nobody had any information pointing to this area specifically. So the idea that warehouses get broken into sometimes, especially when you're not talking about the individual area where my client was located, doesn't get you toward anything pointing to the fact that she was doing anything wrong. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, students of Smoky Hill High School, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado here. I'd like to start by addressing the basic question of, did a Fourth Amendment seizure occur here? Counsel has said that I'm precluded from making this argument on appeal. He said that not in the brief, so I'm just having to talk about that for the first time today. But I think it's important to realize procedurally that suppression cases come to our courts in two ways. One is the way that this case has come before this court, which is a defendant has been convicted and then there's a direct appeal. However, there's also what we call an interlocutory appeal process, where if the prosecution loses the suppression hearing in the trial court, then that ruling can be appealed directly to the Colorado Supreme Court. When there's such a direct appeal to the Colorado Supreme Court, the suppression ruling, the party that lost in the trial court can only rely on those theories that it argued in the trial court. And so that is why when we look at a number of these suppression cases that are Supreme Court cases, they are interlocutory appeals where the people lost below. And so cases like Padgett, for example, are those which are interlocutory appeals. Where a case has come up like this case, where it's been a conviction in the trial court and it is on direct appeal, the people can defend the case on any grounds. And I'd cite the Arnes case, for example, for the fact that people can, in fact, defend the judgment on any grounds. So when we look and say,
well, Ms. Rohrbaugh, aren't suppression cases very fact dependent? And that's why we have to rely on the record and the trial court's findings before looking at the ultimate conclusion.
That's correct. I'm asking this court to make a new legal conclusion, which this court reviews de novo. However, it's absolutely true that we're bound by the factual record made below. However, we have only one witness in this suppression hearing, the deputy involved, Deputy Tanner. And so we have basically undisputed facts. I don't think that there are particular facts in dispute because we have only one version of the facts. The defendant didn't testify at the suppression hearing. So we have one version of facts, which is Deputy Tanner's. And so I think this court can make legal conclusions based upon the facts that we have in the suppression hearing. But I agree absolutely with what you said, that in a suppression context, this court is bound by the evidence that was presented in the suppression hearing.
Well, Ms. Rohrbaugh, at the hearing, the deputy testified that he activated his lights when he pulled up behind. What do you think would have happened if she would have left?
Does that deputy want her to drive away?
I mean, as a matter of common sense, he would have chased her down and charged her with something, some other crime. I mean, why isn't that a stop?
Your Honor, let's start with what we can all agree is a stop, which counsel cited the Jackson case, which said when an officer activates his overhead lights and the person pulls over to the side of the road, that person has submitted to the police show of authority.
And by staying there, she submitted as well.
Maybe, maybe not, because she didn't have to make any action. She was already parked. And I would direct this court to page 19 of the suppression hearing, where the officer testified that it was his belief that the car was in fact parked. Because she was
But he saw brake lights.
He did, yes, absolutely. And that's why this case is different from the Painter case. In the Painter case, the officer turned his spotlights onto a parked car.
He had pretty much every light on, didn't he?
Yes.
And you're telling me that that's not a police stop?
Yes, because a police stop occurs when the individual has submitted to the show of authority. If an officer yells at an individual, hey, you stop, and the person runs away, no stop has occurred. No stop occurs until the person actually stops.
Okay, well, this is not a hey, come here case. This is a turning on overhead lights on a police car case.
Right, but the defendant has not submitted to a show of authority because she's already stopped. If she had to pull over to the side of the road, then she would be submitting to the officer's show of authority.
So it's...
Yeah, in fact.
Well, now wait. So it's the people's position she should have driven away?
It's the people's position that she did not submit to a show of authority by the officer. And for that reason, I think, although it's a close case, that this court could consider that this constituted a consensual encounter in the same way there was a consensual encounter in the Painter case. As I said, in the Painter case, the officer didn't activate the overhead lights, but the officer activated a spotlight and shone it on the parked car. And the Colorado Supreme Court said that did not constitute a seizure of the individuals because the car was parked.
So why do police turn on overhead lights?
Well, certainly when they are trying to stop the driver, they turn on overhead lights in order to provoke a reaction from the driver. I'm just saying...
To not drive away.
Yeah, but here, as I said, the defendant was already stopped. She's in the same sort of position as the individuals were in the Painter case, where the car is already parked. Now, if perhaps the defendant had testified, gee, I wanted to leave, but I didn't do so because the police car had activated its lights, then you might have some submission to the show of authority. But in the absence of such testimony, what we have is a parked car approached by an officer.
Ms. Rohrbaugh,
on every one of his lights.
Let me ask you this question. If I'm driving on I-25 and I think I have some difficulties with my car and I pull over to the side of the road where I'm going to need to make a phone call or something, I pull over to the side of the road and the police officer pulls up behind me, if he turns on his lights, is he then doing an investigatory stop?
I don't think so necessarily, particularly under the situation that you've described. The lights would be a key to oncoming traffic for safety concerns that there are vehicles over by the side of the road. And the officer may not be seizing you. The officer might be able to render assistance if, in fact, you were broken down.
Well, in this case, however, we have no other traffic. Does the officer have a reason for turning on the lights?
The officer turned around because he was suspicious.
The officer was suspicious, but I got to tell you, I have occasionally taken wrong turns and wound up in weird, deserted areas at night. And if it were me in a weird warehouse area and I saw a police car flashing its lights,
you would drive away? You would drive away?
No, I'm saying that I would be happy to have the assistance of the officer. I wouldn't necessarily feel that my liberty was being restrained. And that's another important point, that for a Fourth Amendment seizure, we take into account a reasonable law-abiding citizen.
And counsel, any reasonable law-abiding citizen is going to think when a car comes up behind him, a police car, with all the lights on, that they can't go anywhere.
Well, if they are already stopped, and if the person is lost and perhaps is seeking assistance, that person may not feel seized for Fourth Amendment purposes. But my point
you're splitting hairs, and you have 7 minutes left.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand. I see I have 6:54. Now, let me just say that whether a Fourth Amendment seizure has occurred is based upon your reasonable law-abiding citizen, not your paranoid meth head. And I think that's important when we look at the facts of this case.
No, it is not. No, it is not. We don't get to look at whether she's a paranoid meth head to determine whether the stop is legal or not. We don't
we
get to look at
the reasonable law-abiding citizen's perspective when we determine whether, in fact, the person has been seized. Now, moving on to the second question of if there was, in fact, a seizure, whether there was reasonable suspicion for such a seizure. We then look, and the case of Rush Dooney, I just find, was particularly instructive in this case. We look at the time, we look at the character of the neighborhood, and we look at the defendant's actions. And in this case, it is a really odd hour of the morning. It's 2:45 in the morning. This is a deserted warehouse district where there aren't any other people and really shouldn't be any other people. The deputy testified that it was possible that there might be thefts from such an area in the middle of the night. He was aware that such thefts had occurred.
Let's be clear. I don't recall any testimony in the record that any thefts had occurred at this warehouse district or in this area. He was just saying, hypothetically, warehouses get robbed. And that's just, he wasn't saying anything about this area at all.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that he referred to this area. He certainly didn't refer to a time frame. And that does make this case different from Rush Dooney. Because in Rush Dooney, the people were dumpster diving behind a strip mall where the officer testified there had been recent burglaries. So it was tied to a particular factual circumstance in that case. So it's clear that the testimony in this case is different. The officer testified that, in fact, he was aware that such robberies occurred in such places.
Well, what's the difference between that and somebody getting lost in a residential neighborhood late at night, and then the police officer saying, well, burglaries happen all the time. I can pull you over. I can stop you. What's the difference?
Okay, we have the time. We have the place, and
late at night.
In a residential area, there are reasons why people may be coming home late. And
well, now, wasn't there a residential trailer very close by?
There was a trailer that was in the office or the warehouse district.
That somebody lived in.
It was unclear about whether the trailer was used for business or residential purposes, but that's not where the defendant pulled up. She was not going home to that trailer. She didn't pull up in front of it and go in the front door. But I think it's very different when you talk about a deserted area where no one is around than if you talk about a residential neighborhood where there may be people coming and going from their own homes, or if you talk about a place where there's a bar. I mean, what happened in the Padgett case was that at about bar close time, someone slipped on a street after a blizzard. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, those facts don't constitute reasonable suspicion that a crime occurred. But then it's not all that unusual that people will be leaving bars around bar close time, and they may not be committing crimes. What is interesting about this case is the absolutely deserted nature of the neighborhood.
Well, counsel, I recall just a few minutes ago you saying that you yourself had taken wrong turns and gotten lost and been places where you didn't know where you were. I'll confess to having done the same, perhaps even late at night. It seems to me that's all we have here. And then on top of that, what we have is a hunch. Maybe a hunch that maybe something's amiss, maybe. And it turns out, of course, the hunch is wrong because he's thinking about thefts and there's no issue of a theft here. That's all we've got. We've got late at night, deserted area.
Your Honor, there may or may not be innocent explanations for a lot of what we see and a lot of what police officers see. So it's true that there may be an innocent explanation for why the defendant is in the deserted warehouse district at night, and she may be merely a lost citizen. That is true. I'm saying that the totality of the circumstances here add up to reasonable suspicion on the part of the officer. And I want to mention, too, remember the officer turns off his lights at a certain point, and then he approaches the defendant's car, and he turns all of the lights on. At that point, he sees her doing something in the front seat.
But that's after the lights are on.
Gesture.
That's after the lights are on.
Well, he sees it when the lights are turned on. Now, we have the question of when does the seizure occur, which we've already talked about. But that is something known to him before he walks out and approaches the car. Of course, as soon as he gets up to the window of the car and before he asks the defendant to see her license and to tell him what she's doing there, he sees the marijuana pipe in the console. So if no seizure has occurred at that point, he clearly has probable cause for a seizure. The question really is, when did the seizure occur, and what did the officer know? Would this court like me to distinguish any of the authorities that were cited in this case? I talked a little about the Padgett case. I've talked also about the Painter case and the Rushduni case. The other case, I guess, that's been relied upon in this case would be the Greer case, which had to do with a bar in Colorado Springs called the Cloud Nine, which was notorious for drug dealing. And in one case, which was the Greer case, the Supreme Court said that there was not reasonable suspicion because all we had was some people in this notorious parking lot, and what the officer saw might or might not have been a hand-to-hand gesture and an exchange of money.
And here, we don't even have that here. We don't have high crime neighborhood. We don't have actions by the defendant or behavior by the defendant. I mean, other than sitting in a car.
She may be just sitting in the car, but she's in a warehouse district in the middle of the night, which might be private property. The officer testified he didn't know about the status of it, but he said that he didn't actually have a street name, that this was, in fact, unincorporated Weld County, and this appeared to be part of private business entity. And as this court has pointed out, there was no 7-Eleven there. I mean, there's just no action in the middle of the night. I see I'm now out of time. I thank this court for its time and attention, and I ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction.
The Attorney General talked about a furtive gesture once the lights came on. That's not disputed. That happened. But for all the reasons that we talked about at the beginning of the argument, Judge Berman, that doesn't enter into the analysis of whether or not the stop itself was supported by reasonable suspicion.
So the stop would be when lights, from your position, when the lights were activated, the overhead lights.
That's correct. Yeah, as the panel has pointed out, first thing you learn in driver's ed class is that when the lights come on behind you, you stop. And the standard here for a Fourth Amendment seizure is just not being able to continue on about your way. So that's right. I mean, as soon as the lights came on, the seizure was in effect. Now, discussing what part of the totality of the circumstances we're supposed to look at here, the Attorney General is correct. We do look at the time, we look at the character of the neighborhood, and we look at the defendant's actions. And what we didn't hear anything about was my client's actions. Of course, it was deserted, it was a dark and scary place. But there's nothing here that points to what my client was doing. You're right, Deputy Tanner testified that he was concerned about theft. He testified that he was concerned about a half dozen different varieties of criminal activity. He said he was worried about wire theft, tool theft, littering, or in his own words, any number of things. Being concerned about any number of things is not an articulable and specific basis to believe that a crime is about to be committed. An officer's suspicion that something just doesn't look right is nothing more than an unarticulated hunch. And our Colorado courts have consistently held that an unarticulated hunch is not a reason to seize someone and deprive them of one of the most important liberties that we have.
So why is the officer even in that area and patrolling? Isn't he there to be securing the safety and the security of the area?
Absolutely. And to be clear, Your Honor, my argument is not that the officer just had to keep on driving down the street. There's absolutely no reason why he couldn't follow her into the warehouse. He could trail her all the way across town for the rest of the night if he wanted to. The point is, he initiated a seizure and deprived her of her liberty of movement before he had any reason to do so that was related to her activity. And that's where the constitutional violation is. There are no more questions from the court. I'd like to conclude just by reiterating that in the end, this case is not just about Valerie Ehrlich. It's about me, and it's about everybody else in this room. Whether when we're on our way home from school or from work tonight, we can be seized by police simply because we turned our car off the road. Allowing that to happen is inconsistent with the Constitution, and it is inconsistent with fundamental concepts of what it means to live in a free society. I respectfully request this court give effect to those concepts and reverse the trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And I thank all of you in the audience for your attention and for respect for the arguments. We will leave now. We will be adjourned, and we will leave. We will come back in a few minutes. Thank you.